with using of the X-ray. But they were kind of very puzzling to me. And remember that we, a few weeks ago, we spoke about the gentleman with, from NASA, and then a week ago, I sent you the material about the electric motor that is based on a magnet, that one that is hanging on a screw. All of these three subjects comes to one particular point. The guy is trying to make a mechanical device that runs forever according to the Newton's law. The body puts in motion, the body not staying in motion in the environment. That was one of the primary questions. What could we do if you want to just to repeat what is happening in space? There was another question that he has made. Let me just... So, if you look at that last video, a first page of the button, you see a very much strange structure where the core, or let's say the coil, for him doesn't matter, is kind of 45 degrees to the cutter. And when it turns, it simply changes the pattern. By explaining this the star-like structure that moves not only around, in between, but also moves up and down, you are just mimicking that particular pattern, but a little bit different fashion. I believe John would be able right now to give the rest of the feedback as he has a better wording to describe that. John, please.
KT2WGB. Well, Dick, when I looked at that first video and I was running through that, I wondered, is he applying power to it or not? It's a device that when it starts and spinning, what is this, perpetual motion? Is this going to keep revolving? Don't know. I didn't see any coils on that. It just looks like full body. So, then when you look at his transformer position, it shows field, if we have one, so that's very confusing, that whole thing to me. Anyway, back to you, Dick.
The answer is very simple. For him, it doesn't matter where we
send it over to Dick.
He's trying to compare both like they were alike. So, he says that whatever he does with the magnet could be also made with the coil. He's clearly showing that the magnetic field around the conductor, one of the units, he shows just a loop of the wire. He's showing how the magnetic field is concentrated. He's even showing, like, from one side of the conductor only, the magnetic field is more saturated. So, for me, it looks like when he says, let's go to the X-ray, he must have looked at any kind of screen device seeing the magnetic flux. One of the ways of doing this is that green stuff that the plant tells you, so if you would like to...
KQLIW here. Looks like I'm able to ride this particular guy. The three videos that you mailed us, Wes, number one, two, and three, are neither of those are showing the particular patent. The Morey, I think you said the patent. I didn't see that particular one. Also, when it comes to the so-called inverse square law of a magnetic field situation, in other words, when two magnets are close to each other, or when one is retracted from the other, and the force falls off as a function of distance, that's a fairly well-known phenomena. I'm wondering, you're saying that he's using it somehow in order to try to get greater efficiency. Is that what he's trying to do, Wes? N2XJN, K2RI.
Repeater.
K2RIW testing. Looks like I can come through by way of the alternate. What was really being said by those alternate distances, in other words, inverse square law of magnetic field fall off, was that claiming to create some kind of a increase in performance? That wasn't quite clear to me as to what was being claimed in that particular case. Back to you, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
KC2WGB, Dick, I'm at a loss. I have nothing really to say or to add to this because until it's better explained to me, first of all, I don't know what he's trying to say he can do with this device. I look at it mechanically. I can see how it works. I can see how the central part of those three armatures can be connected to a rotating cam device or something like that. But as far as what he's doing electrically or mechanically, I have no idea.
Well, let me branch over for a second back to the mailbag, and then we'll come back to this one, John. We're about at the right time. We should be going to the mailbag. So give us mailbag number one, item number one, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
Okay, Dick. KC2WGB. Now we'll go to Mel's mailbag here. Let's see. Have an interesting antenna design this gentleman is working on. It's similar to a bazooka, but he's going to need some help here, so let me let drop for a second. All right. On this antenna, what he has done, he's taken a piece of three-quarter copper pipe, approximately 24 inches long. He placed a length of RG8U through the center, got to the top, he flayed back the foil, soldered it directly, the braid, directly to the copper pipe in a ring. Now he had a stub sticking above that, which he attached a 20-inch piece of hardened copper number 6 wire, about 20 inches long. He did that through a glass Edison insulator, which looks nice. I mean, sounds like a great design. And to me, it strikes me as a type of bazooka antenna. Cannot get the ratio, the coefficient, better than 1.4. And he wants to know if adding radios to the copper.
You suddenly dropped out, John. But if I understand correctly, he's got a piece of copper pipe. The RG8 is going through the center of it at the exact length of the pipe you told me, but I've forgotten it. He's got the braid spread out at the end, soldered in a ring to the end of the copper pipe. And then I presume it's the center conductor of the RG8, which he could have just let it with the polyethylene extend for the next 20 inches, or he could have cut away the polyethylene and just let the center conductor stick out. But I think you're saying by way of the Edison insulator, which probably is supplying the mechanical support, he has a 20-inch long rod. And, by the way, it's somewhat similar to a so-called quarter wave whip on 2 meters. People who make a quarter wave whip usually make the radiator section 19 inches long. And so the fact that he's got a 1.4 standing wave ratio, he is not bad. To the average person, that's pretty good. Maybe he's a little bit more of a perfectionist. Let me drop. But he wants the Vizwar to be lower than 1.4 to 1. One of the interesting things he could do, since this is a 2-meter operation and he's measuring the standing wave ratio, and maybe he's trying to tune this to, let's say, 146 megacycles, he could tune his transmitter down to 144, 144.5, 145, 145.5. In other words, sweep the frequency across the 2-meter band and measure the visual on each one of those points and plot it. And he's either going to get a bathtub-shaped curve or he's going to get a slanted curve. He'll rapidly find out that at some other frequency, it gives a better standing wave ratio, and that'll give him a very strong clue that his 20-inch radiator is a little bit too long. The ground plane radios, yes, they will make a difference. And is it going to be an improvement or a non-improvement? That's not easy to answer. However, sweeping the frequency first will tell him whether or not his 20-inch object is too long, and I think it's too long. It's only an inch too long, but I think it's too long. And that's an aggravating factor. But even if he used it as is with a 1.4 standing wave ratio, for almost every transmitter you and I are likely to use, that's going to give you within 2/10 of a dB the full power output. Almost no rig that you and I know is going to complain on VHF about 1.4. Some of the no-tune rigs on HF frequencies, 1.4, 1.5, is where they might start cutting back in power. But most VHF rigs are very forgiving. So he doesn't have to do anything, but the next step would be to sweep the frequency and experiment with different lengths. And yes, he could put the three radios down at a 45-degree angle from the horizon, each one of those 19 inches long, solder them to the perimeter of the copper pipe, right where the blade is soldered. That would be a more conventional ground plane antenna. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay. Well, I'm sure he has plenty of time to work on that. I think it's a good system. It looks like a very sturdy construction. I don't think you have any problem mounting it. And having the radio slide up and down is interesting to me. but I would normally solder that right at where the braid is soldered, just like you suggested. But I think you can work with it. And I don't know if he's trimmed it lower than 20 inches yet in his trimming techniques, whether he's tried to improve the 1.4 by doing that. But like you said, he could find out the correct length by sweeping, just like he could with the generator. He could do the same thing with the receiver. But, okay, very good. Ready for the next one?
I think we're ready for the next one, John. Go right ahead. K2RIW and the TechNet.
Okay. Now, this is a good one. This gentleman has taken a 24-inch square piece of plexiglass. And on one side, he put a the driven element of a quad, actually. It's a square, 19 inches on the side, and the connections are on the vertical. So he has a an antenna on one side of this plate mounted on these little extension knobs. On the other side, he has the same exact antenna, only the opening is at the bottom. So now he can switch between polarities of this loop antenna. He would like to know if there's any benefit separating the two. He has two down leads to it, both RG8U. He's using this M2, and he's having a good time with it, but now he's looking to improve on it. Do you think separating them or putting a metal plate between them or anything like that would make a difference? Back to you, Dick.
Interesting antenna. A typical quad, ordinarily, it's approximately one wavelength mechanical circumference is the way it's usually done. If you study electronically what's happening, it's really, if you feed it at the back, it really is a pair of vertically stacked dipoles. In other words, from the bottom feeding point off to the right and halfway up the right side and halfway up the left side is the first half-wave dipole, and then the rest of the wire all around the perimeter is the second half-wave dipole, vertically stacked. So there's two half-wave horizontally polarized dipoles vertically stacked when you feed it at the bottom. By way of him, you didn't tell me the thickness of the plexiglass, but it doesn't matter too much. By him stacking a second one behind, where he's feeding one of them along the side to be vertically polarized, and the other one he's feeding in the bottom to be horizontally polarized, that's a very interesting technique. Because they are only separated by the thickness of the plastic, let's assume the plastic is a quarter inch thick, so they're separated by a quarter inch, there is a very tight coupling between those two loops. Therefore, when he's transmitting horizontal on the one that's fed at the bottom, he is launching some horizontal polarized signal into the other loop. And therefore, there will be, with the right kind of instrumentation, let me come back. With the right kind of instrumentation, he will be able to detect that there's a significant amount of current flowing on the outside of the coax cable of the other cubicle quad. They are fairly tightly coupled by that quarter inch spacing. It's not a showstopper. And if he's willing to put the right kind of an RF choke in the coaxial cable, as close to the antenna as you can get, a poor man's Fallon would be one way of doing it. A number of turns of the coaxial cable right at the antenna taped together would be an RF choke. The sophisticated way would be to do it with ferrite, large ferrite toroids on the outside of the coax cable, or the coax wrapped through a toroid. And to find the right kind of ferrite material that has good performance at 2 meters, you'd have to be a little bit careful. But by using the right kind of an RF choke, we can now make the current that wants to flow in the coax cable stop at the RF choke. And now he really would have, with that choking mechanism, two thoroughly independent antennas, one horizontally polarized, one vertically polarized, and not very much, almost no, cross-coupling between the two. So the only mechanism of the cross-coupling is the current launched in the cable of the unfed antenna. And by choking, he'd make that go away. That's an idea I haven't thought of. I mean, various people have tried to put horizontal feed and vertical feed on the same cubicle quad. And they have not been met with a great deal of success. In other words, they had an awful lot of interaction between the two. There's quarter inch of spacing and just stacking two of them, because the wire of the cubicle quad is very inexpensive. So stacking one on the near side and one on the far side of the plastic is a very crafty idea. I know somebody who can use that. I know somebody in the business that I work with, in the place where I do consulting, I know somebody who can use that. I think he's come up with something good. The only missing ingredient was the RF choke. With the RF choke, I think he can make that perfect, John. That's a goodie. Give that man a star. KC2 WGB K2LIW.
Okay, Dick, I might return the email to him. Also, I forgot to mention, well, I did mention, they're on knobs, which are about 2 inches off the plate. So there's about a 4-inch separation between the two. But adding a balance, a choke on those two, will probably give them the benefit of not having that coupling. So that is a good idea, and I'm sure he'll take that suggestion if he hears it.
Yeah, he's got a goodie there, John. And give that guy a star. The fact that he's got them mounted on knobs as opposed to being directly glued to the plastic, that's just his desire for a particular mechanical arrangement and how strong he wants to make it. But separating them by a couple of inches, or having them not separated at all, or separated only by the thickness of the plastic, that's a fairly minor detail. By my standards, until you separate those two loops by, a good eighth of a wavelength or more, let me think now, eighth of a wavelength is around 4 inches. Until you separate them by an eighth of a wavelength or more, they are very tightly coupled to each other. So whether you have them a quarter inch apart or an inch and a half apart is somewhat academic. When it comes to the so-called mutual impedance phenomena, you go to the right kind of an antenna book, the ARL antenna book, for instance, and you look at the subject of mutual impedance for dipoles, and a cubicle quad really is the first cousin of a dipole, even though it doesn't look it. If you look at the mutual impedance curves, that will give you a hint as to how much coupling there is, and you'll find that the coupling is very tight until you get to at least an eighth wavelength or so of separation between the two. So that's somewhat academic, the fact that he's got separation. But all of that coupling essentially goes away with the RF choke. The disadvantage of the coupling goes away with the RF chokes. I think he's got a goodie, and give him encouragement, John. He should keep working on things like that, and I think we've got another brand new antenna engineer. That's a rare art in black science, antenna engineering on VHF frequencies, and so he deserves a lot of encouragement, John. And go on to the next one, KC2WGB, K2RIW.
Okay, Dick. Well, he accidentally did a good job because, or maybe he didn't. The knobs are 2 inches, so he does have a 4-inch separation. So he lucked out with that, or maybe he thought of it. But okay, let me let it drop and I'll go on to the next one. Another antenna question, by the way. All right, this gentleman heard our conversation about the infamous slot antenna. Now, his question is, if he were to take a 24-inch square piece of copper, expensive, and cut his slot in it, and he's used, and he's getting some great results with it. It's actually working. And he was able to tune it perfectly by attaching the coaxial cable at different points along that line of the slots on opposite sides until he got a very good reading. Now he wants to know if he were to take it, now it's vertically, the slot is vertically cut, so it's a horizontally polarized antenna, I assume. If he were to take from the top and bottom, rotate it, twist it 45 degrees to put a spiral in that plate, what would happen to his propagation pattern? Sort of an odd question, but what's your answer then? KC2WGB, back to you.
Another very good idea. Hey, these guys are really something else. Boy, you're turning these people on, John. Wow. Oh, that is a beauty. He is beginning to build a spiral antenna, but he's doing it as a slot spiral, or a skeleton slot spiral. And by the way, you can take the perimeter of the slot and make that into wire and not use all of the rest of the sheet metal. It's a different antenna with somewhat similar characteristics. That's a so-called skeleton slot. But in the case of the slot antenna, he's got his 24-inch square piece of copper. I am guessing the slot he has cut is something rather close to 19 inches in length, because the slot itself has to be very close to a half wavelength in free space in order to hit resonance. And you can easily find out where resonance is by making the slot longer and shorter by soldering pieces of copper across the edges. And as you make a capacitor across the slot in the center, you can electronically tune the slot. He could, in other words, put a piece of copper across the slot in the center where it's soldered on one side, but it's got a piece of plastic of some kind making sure that it doesn't make contact on the other side. It's just a capacitor. And by bending it, he can change the amount of capacitance, and he can tune the antenna. So by putting capacitance across the center, and by moving the coax cable up and down, he can make the impedance perfect. He can make the frequency perfect, if you know what I mean. But by the twist he's talking about, he is beginning to build a spiral antenna. However, the helix, he's beginning to build a helix antenna, and he's going to twist it, I think you said 45 degrees. I'm going to go all the way. What happens if he twists at 90 or 180? The upper half and the lower half will be out of phase with each other as far as the radiated pattern is concerned. It will still radiate, but it's going to be a very complicated pattern. Not easy to predict. It will radiate. But where will the peaks and valleys be, and what will the polarization be? Not easy to predict. I know somebody who's going to be building that in the next week or so, or John. I'm not actually targeted on this one. It's quite a trip. I thought he was building a helical antenna. Let me drop. And he's built a couple of them in a mesh in such a way that in theory you could build a quadrifile helix. NDIS. Could you make that into an NDIS antenna? Was that your question, John? Go ahead.
No, would it start to radiate in that fashion with that twist?
Okay, I think I can make some predictions on this one. Huh. All of a sudden, the time delay is not bothering me as much. I'm amazed. NDIS, no. I was going to make a comment. All of a sudden, I've lost the subject matter. Would this be a... Repeat the question, John, please.
Well, I asked if when he took his antenna, which is the sheet, the slot antenna. Oh, by the way he tuned it was very, very techy. He has an inverse clip of an alligator. When you squeeze it, it closes. When you release, it opens. He put that in the slot and slid it up and down to get a perfect tune. And then he soldered a piece of copper across that. Just an update on that. What I was asking is, as he twists that copper, would it start to become an NV? Would it start to radiate in the vertical direction?
So now I understand the question. First of all, let's start off with the slot itself. By Babinet's rule, a slot has the identical pattern as a dipole, with one exception. The E field and the H field are reversed. So in other words, as you already know, a slot that's cut in a vertical manner on a sheet of copper is a horizontally polarized antenna. So it would act almost identical to a horizontally polarized dipole. A dipole is parallel to the ground, even though the slot itself is vertical. It will have that exact pattern. As you twist it, at first you would think it's going to be a little bit like a turnstile, a horizontally polarized turnstile antenna, but not quite. Because the top half and the bottom half of the slot are, by definition, in the slot itself, co-phase, you're now radiating co-phase with a twist to the top and the bottom, and I think it's really just a more complicated way of making a dipole at a 45 degree angle, if you know what I mean. In other words, a dipole, if you rotate it in azimuth, this is a horizontal dipole parallel to the ground, and you rotated the azimuth of the dipole by approximately 45 degrees. That's my first guess as to what the pattern is going to be. It might not give you a great deal of benefit. Now, the one thing that's different about this slot, it's a horizontally polarized dipole, which does the vertical slot have energy radiated off the ends? Let me think about that for a second. Yeah, the dipole, the vertical slot is acting like a horizontal dipole. The horizontal dipole, without a doubt, has a donut pattern, so that the to the wire in all cases, it's radiating an equal amplitude signal, broadside to the wire at all elevation angles, a horizontal dipole parallel to the ground. And in theory, a vertical slot is doing that. Right now I'm having a little bit of trouble picturing how the vertical slot can radiate a signal off of its ends. But I guess it's sort of got to do that. And wouldn't that be a good NEVIS antenna? Well, in the case of VHF frequencies, slots are used on VHF and UHF frequencies. Very, very few people are willing to build a slot down at HF frequencies. And the only place I know of where we really desire, let me drop, a so-called NEVIS antenna, a near vertical incident skywave antenna. The only place where we really desire that is on HF frequencies, where the MUF is, maximum usable frequency, is low enough that you can send the signal straight up to the ionosphere and bounce it straight down again, because you want to talk to somebody at a short range. A NEVIS antenna on, let's say, 80 or 40 meters or 20 meters probably would be good to talk to your buddy in Philadelphia from Long Island, or to talk to your buddy in New Jersey from Long Island. A NEVIS antenna would be appropriate to do that. But the size the slot would be at HF frequencies is so large that it's not practical. And yes, you can easily build a slot at 2 meters and above, not likely at 6 meters, but 2 meters and above, you can certainly build one. But there you don't need near vertical incident skywave. The ionosphere is not there on 2 meters 99.5% of the time. Yeah, you do get some glancing reflection off the ionosphere during a sporadic E event. But the sporadic E would not give you reflection for near vertical incident skywave. The nice thing about VHF is that the short distances that we need a NEBUS antenna for on HF, you don't need it on VHF. Just aim a Yagi at the horizon and you easily talk to your buddy in New Jersey and Pennsylvania and Maryland and Delaware and maybe even Virginia if you've got a good location, a little bit of sideband power. So to talk those frequencies by what looks like ground wave on VHF is fairly easy, so you don't need NEBUS. The next question is going to be, how come I can't do that on HF? And the answer, you can. The trouble is, the amount of noise of the ionosphere is so great that it takes the huge signal you get by ionospheric reflection to overcome that noise for you to hear the signal above threshold. You aim a 20-meter antenna, horizontally polarized, at your buddy in Philadelphia, and the signal is getting to him, without a doubt. He's not hearing it because the sky noise is so loud. Without ionospheric reflection, he doesn't hear it. So because the ionospheric noise is so low, so quiet on VHF, you don't need NEBUS. So there may be a NEBUS capability, but I don't think he could use it, if you know what I mean. KC2WGB, K2LIW.
GB. I agree, Dick. The only other question I have about his construction is the amount of metal he used. I understand the 24-inch length, so he can cut his slot, but why did he make it 24-inch in width, maybe for rigidity? I don't know. But I think if he would have made it 6 inches, it probably would have been sufficient. I don't think he would need much more copper than that. What do you think about that?
Yeah, now we're getting into the area of skeleton slot antennas. He could make a piece of 14-gauge copper wire, follow the perimeter of the slot that he has cut. Let me do a quick experiment here. Oh, yeah. Looks like I can cut my power back a little bit. He could take a piece of 14-gauge wire, lay it in the perimeter of his slot, close the end of it and solder it, pick it away from the piece of sheet metal, readjust his clip lead a little bit, maybe readjust the center capacitor, and re-resonate it. It now would be a skeleton slot, and its radiation characteristics would be, let me think about that, what would the radiation characteristics be? Almost the same. Very similar. So you're absolutely right. The 24-inch width, he didn't need it. As he decreases that 24-inch width, it will make a very slow, slight change in the pattern. I think the roll becomes a little bit more broad as you do that. He didn't need all the width. He could have saved the copper. So, if he looks up slot antennas and then compares them against a so-called skeleton slot antenna, he's going to see a very strong similarity. It'll take a little bit of retuning, but he could get there. Back to you, John. K2LIW.
DC2WGB. Well, then my recommendation to him, I assume he cut it in the center, I would put a 440 slot on the right, put a 23-centimeter slot on the left, and he could have three antennas on the same sheet. What do you think about that, Dick?
Yeah, I try. And they would have almost no cross-coupling. He could bring out all of the coax cables. Let me think that one. The easiest way to bring out the coax cable, which is opposite of common sense, is that he's feeding across this vertical slot the actual feed probe. He's putting his coax cable, the shield on the left side, the center conductor on the right side, and he's feeding it in a horizontal manner, but it's a horizontally polarized antenna. As soon as the coax cable leaves the vicinity of the slot, makes a right-hand turn on the copper, and then comes out the bottom of the copper sheet, he'll have the minimum coupling of signal to the outside blade of his copper. And he could do that on all three antennas. So yes, if he's got enough real estate on that slot, he could build slots for quite a number of bands simultaneously. And the nice thing about a slot is that it has rather sharp frequency characteristics. It's a fairly high Q structure. As such, if he builds a slot for 146 megacycles, and he does a test at 156 megacycles, it'll have almost no response at 156. It's tuned to 146, if you know what I mean. So therefore, the other bands will have no response unless they happen to be very close to an exact harmonic. The first harmonic that the slot will operate on is the third harmonic, and then the fifth harmonic. All of the odd harmonic frequencies the slot will respond to. And most of our VHF frequencies, let's see, 2 meters and 432 do enjoy a 3-to-1 relationship. Believe it or not, with some variation in the way he does things, he could put 432 energy into the 2-meter slot. Let me drop. However, if he did that, it would resonate rather well, but the radiation pattern would be complicated. It would be a 3-half wave dipole. It would be a 1-half wave length long slot. And would there be a signal on the horizon is the next question. You have to think about that one. So you'd be better off building a real 432 slot, a real 2-meter slot, a real 1296 slot, and so on. And with some reasonable spacing between the two, they won't have a great deal of cross-coupling. So yes, that one sheet of copper could have quite a number of VHF antennas. And the slot itself doesn't have to be straight. Just like the dipole, when you build a dipole out of wire, you can zigzag it and bend it in all kinds of directions in three-dimensional space. The slot itself, you can zigzag it in various ways and make curves in it. And you'll be changing pattern. You'll be changing the resonant frequency a little bit. You'll be changing the bandwidth a little bit. You'll be changing the pattern. So there's a whole series of experiments that can be done by making slots that are not straight, wrapping them around each other almost, as for the various bands. KC2, WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
KC2, WGB. Yes, I think he could have a lot of fun with this. I just hope he's listening. I hope he's able to copy. But, yeah, innovative, and I think it'll work fine. And I do have an antenna question also, if you got time.
Fire away, John.
Related a story about a gentleman you were talking to on 10 gigahertz, and he was in his backyard and had his antenna wire. The cable was disconnected from his antenna. He was holding it in his hand, and he was receiving, you were receiving. Now, was that piece of wire, I believe it was, was that piece of wire acting as a horn type of device, or was that a bazooka type of antenna? That would be, how is he receiving that? What type of antenna was that structure? Remember the story?
I sure do remember the story. This was Bruce, N2LIV, who lives in Neskonset. He is 10 airline miles from me. From the top of my tower at the 100-foot level, with a 2-foot diameter dish, I'm radiating 2/10 of a watt, 200 milliwatts of signal on 10.368 gigahertz. And he's receiving me on a horn in his backyard. The horn was sitting up on a wooden stepladder. The trees in his backyard in this concert are approximately 50 feet high. We've already discovered that the signal was strongest when he aimed his high-gain dish antenna at the tops of the trees. Of course, the signal comes across the tops of the trees from my house to his house, and then the signal... after it leaves the tops of his trees, it curves down at a 45-degree angle and goes to the dish in the middle of his backyard, in the middle of his mowed lawn where he was sitting, so to speak. So we had finished running our experiment. He started taking things apart, and the receiver was running. I left the transmitter on while he was doing this, and he had disconnected the SMA connector, the 3-millimeter connector, from the horn. So the 3-millimeter male connector, with this piece of semi-rigid coax cable, with the rest of the rig mounted on this wooden stepladder, that piece of SMA connector, the center pin of an SMA connector, which sticks out approximately a quarter of an inch. When I say sticks out, I mean the center pin is a quarter of an inch long. It doesn't stick out. It doesn't come beyond the barrel of the connector. This is a male connector. But because it's a quarter inch long, it is a kind of a monopole. It is a sleeve monopole antenna, quarter wavelength long. And he realized he's hearing the signal weakly in the noise. And he reported that back to me on the 2-meter liaison frequency real fast. And we did a series of experiments and found out that at the 10-mile range, in our particular locations, as long as I aim my antenna carefully at his backyard, he could receive me on the SMA connector all by itself. As he aimed it around in various directions, he could find out when the polarity was right, where the signal would peak at the... I hope I didn't time that out. Yeah. As I was starting to say, as he aimed that SMA connector on the end of the piece of semi-rigid cable in various directions in the yard, he could easily see at what polarity he was picking me up. I was radiating horizontal polarity, and when the center conductor of his SMA connector was parallel to the ground is when he got the strongest signal. But not necessarily. The polarization was being a little bit randomized by the trees. So, the quarter wavelength long center conductor inside of a male SMA connector was the antenna. When you get up to frequency as high as 10 gigs, what ordinarily would be a well-shielded structure, a type M connector, male or female, at most of the frequencies we operate at, even though you don't put a short circuit at the end of it, cap it off, so to speak, it doesn't do a very good job of radiating. The SMA connector on the front panel of your signal generator is not going to squirt the signal into the room unless the signal generator is up at 10 gigs. Now it's starting to radiate because it's a quarter wavelength long structure. Ain't that interesting? KC2WGB, K2RAW in the TechNet.
Yes, I've noticed that with some of my generators, that if I don't put the cover on them, they do radiate at that frequency. But very interesting. I was just wondering what type of antenna that would have been called. So a sleeve antenna, basically, or a tunnel antenna. Okay, very good. And I guess that's it from Noel's mailbag here. Interesting, I had some good questions. I'm glad you could help.
Now, these guys are giving me some ideas. Just a very nice antenna capability that some of these guys are experimenting. That's where ham radio operators these days really shine. When it comes to antenna experimentation, you open up the Antenna Engineering Handbook by Jasek, Johnson, or Volasek. Those are the various issues of that. The version issue is not the right word. I'm trying to think. But you know what I mean. The first printing. It's not printing I'm talking about. You eventually tell me what word I'm missing. But the fourth issue of the Antenna Engineering Handbook by Volasek and all of the earlier versions, you count up the kinds of antennas. And you could make a case that there are 5,000 kinds. But if you take a look at the monthly journal by the IEEE, the Institute of Electrical and Electronic Engineers, the subdivision on antennas and propagation, the AP group, you'll see in the back of every issue, every monthly issue, about 5 or 10 brand new antenna patents that have been invented just that particular month, so to speak, or issued that particular month. So antennas are being invented all the time. Because antennas in general, are made out of materials that usually are not very expensive. Therefore, we amateurs can do a very good job of not spending a lot of money, but doing a lot of experimenting in our cellar, our backyard, our rooftop, wherever, on antennas. And don't be discouraged because someone has led you to believe it, and unfortunately there are a couple of electrical engineering professors at some of the respected schools who will tell you that there's only a few kinds of antennas. You bend up a piece of wire in various ways and you can make all of them. They'll tell you things like that. Oh boy, as I said, there's really 5,000 kinds. When you group together horns and parabolic dishes and offset-fed parabolic dishes and dipoles and slow-wave structures and Yagis and polyrad antennas, and it just goes on and on and on. There's 5,000 kinds of antennas. And just because you think there's a large number doesn't mean that they've all been invented. Oh, boy. There's a lot of brand new use of materials, particularly when you start getting into what's called metamaterials. There are various ways you can combine conductors and dielectric materials in which you can synthesize over narrow frequency regions dielectric constants that are very high, very low, or negative. You can synthesize negative dielectric materials in both permittivity and permeability. You can synthesize negative materials, which have some very interesting properties. In other words, the RF world has the equivalent of what you can do with, let me drop, what you can do with things like a very fancy crystals in the optical world, where you can get birefringence, and in other words, you can have materials that have a divergent constant of one value for vertically polarized waves and a different value for horizontally polarized waves. You can put a light wave into the right kind of a crystal, and you're starting off with a linear wave, and what comes out is a circular polarized wave. Or you can put frequency A into the crystal, and out comes frequency B. The 535 nanometer green lasers we all use really has a crystal in there that's doing a frequency doubling operation. The real laser is running at an infrared frequency at twice the wavelength of 535. What is that? 1070 nanometers. And the crystal is doubling the frequency or halving the wavelength, and out comes green, even though what went in was infrared. So crystals can do some very fancy things in optics, and the RF people are finding out you can do some very fancy things with RF, with the right kind of materials. You can do many of the optical trips. You can make lenses at RF frequencies very nicely, and I've done a few of those. You could go to another letter if you wanted to, John. KC2WGB, K2LAW in the TechNet.
Well, Dick, that's basically all I have for this week at work. But I do have another question, if you got a moment.
Tonight I have another moment, and go right ahead and take your time, John.
Okay, Dick. No, I just don't want to hog it up with my problem. I had a client in here a couple of weeks ago. We've been working on a project. And I remember you mentioning gold and its specific use for a certain optical frequency. Remember that conversation of what that frequency was or what color spectrum it was?
Yeah, I sure do, John. And by the way, thank you for that mailing, which I got a couple of days ago. The connector itself strikes me as a pure BNC connector, single hole mount type BNC connector. However, that krypton thing at the end of the coax cable, which then gets plugged into the back of the BNC, and then I guess another crimping operation takes place, is a very nice way of assembling that BNC between coax. It looks like it applies a little bit of strain relief. So that's a very nicely constructed connector. I've never seen one like that before. Okay. Now, Airborne Instruments Laboratory manufactured something that's called RMM. It is a 8-inch diameter telescope being fed with a infrared source at the eyepiece. The infrared source goes to, let me pick a number, 1,000 feet of air. It runs into something that's acting like a corner reflector cube. The signal gets reflected by the corner reflector cube and comes back through the same remote molecular indicator, RMI. Something like that was the name of this product. Anyhow, by sending the wave through the air twice, you sent this wave through the air to the corner reflector 1,000 feet away and back, and you set this up alongside of a fence of, say, for instance, a chemical factory. Let me drop. You set this up on the fence of a chemical factory, and therefore, when you look at the spectrum, I think the source may have been a broadband source, the more I think about it, or maybe it was a source that swept in wavelength, swept in frequency. Anyhow, by looking at the reflected energy through the 1,000-foot path of air, measuring the signal that comes back, and you plot signal strength versus frequency, was one of the ways I think it was being done. You got a spectrograph, and now you had certain suck-out lines, and a suck-out line in this particular position would represent formaldehyde, and another suck-out line would represent ammonia. In other words, by looking at the signature of the suck-outs through the 1,000-foot of air when you sent the signal through, you immediately found out exactly what chemistry, in parts per billion or parts per million, of what kind of aerosols were in that air path. That corner reflector and also the parabolic mirror on the telescope were made not by covering them with silver like you would with an ordinary telescope. A silver-like material is what you cover your parabolic mirror with on your Newtonian telescope. They covered it with gold. The reason they covered it with gold is because gold as a reflecting object looks golden to you. Let me drop.
It looks golden to your eye because it reflects the red end of the spectrum better than the blue end of the spectrum. That's why it takes on that reddish color that you and I call gold. So when you make your mirror reflecting surface out of gold, it does a beautiful job of reflecting an infrared signal. The source of the signal that is being transmitted by this telescope as a beam across this 1,000 foot of air in my example, well, I wish I could think of the name of the thing, RMM, Remote Molecular, Remote and Molecular was two of the words of the name, Measurement, Remote Molecular Measurement, maybe that's what it was called. Anyhow, this is a product that the company made, which sold rather well, very sophisticated, and so by making the reflectors out of gold, it did a better job of reflecting the infrared signal than a Seebeck mirror. A Seebeck mirror starts running out of steam when you get down to those lower frequency or those larger wavelengths. So, depending on what you're building your what frequency region or what wavelength region you're building your telescope at, you use different materials. You and I, with an optical telescope, are going to use silver-like materials for the reflector. An infrared telescope should use gold. An ultraviolet telescope uses some other material. By the time you get up to soft and hard X-rays, you use a very different material in order to make the lens. That was the next thing. The Galileo camera that AIO made, you now needed to make a lens that would do a lensing operation on gamma rays in order to make a picture. And boy, was that an unusual-looking lens. I won't go there yet. But so far we're answering your particular question, John. KC2WGB, K2IOW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Very good, Dick. I was wondering because, you know, the information given to you when you're working with these people is on a need-to-know basis. So I was wondering why this major problem they're having with a gold coating, which I thought was going to be plated, but it's going to be a deposition problem. Effort, chemicals or something, so they're going to change it around. By the way, that BNC connector, that plugs in the back and does not get crimped. That's it. You just plug it in and it's great. And we put almost 1,000 of those in one installation. And they're kind of pricey, but they're beautiful for being able to remove the back of an instrument or something like that. Just unplug all those things. The BNC connectors are free. So, That worked out very well in the job. I thought maybe you've never seen one of those, and that's why I sent it over.
Yeah, let me ask you this question, John. Let me make sure I got my machine set right. Yes, I do. Once you plugged it in the back, you crimped that connector onto the coax cable, you plug it into the back of the BNC, and now you've got a complete connector. And it doesn't get crimped. It's just is it a press fit? If you wanted to, could you disassemble that crimped-on portion of the coaxial cable back out of the BNC connector? Over to you, John.
Yes, you can, Dick. I forget how many insertions were allowed. I think it was something like 10,000. It was guaranteed to keep same resistivity for 10,000 connections or insertions. So pretty well done. And I think that cable on there is like the RG174. It's not really rated for outdoor use, but interconnects inside of equipment. Beautiful stuff, very flexible. And that's all gold.
To your knowledge, John, do they rate the number of insertions and extractions that you could do? And that's question number one. And also shielding. a well-installed BNC connector probably has 90 decibels or more of shielding. Now, this because it's a slightly more complicated interface on the crimped-on portion and the way it's inserted into the back of the BNC, possibly it's what's the word I'm looking for? It's not going to have quite as much shielding characteristic. So I wonder if the number of insertions or if the shielding was rated. You probably weren't really concerned. You were concerned with having an easy assembly process, and you probably didn't need exactly 90 dB or more of shielding, so that wasn't a problem. And you probably not were going to disassemble it very often, so the number of insertions was probably not a variable. Over to you, John. KT2WGB, KT2LAW. Just go ahead and talk, John.
Kind of amazing that various materials give you various reflections at various wavelengths. You and I would ordinarily think that putting a silver material onto a mirror would work at all frequencies you care about. Well, it doesn't do as good a job at infrared. Because you're trying to get